This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Good afternoon. I'm Chris Nolte. It's Thursday, which means it's Reporters Roundtable Thursday. We'll call on reporters here within the media in Northwest Indiana and the rest of the state to talk about the stories that they have covered this week. We're going to get two different takes, no doubt, of the Indiana Senate candidates debate that happened this week at Purdue University Northwest in Westville. We'll first talk with Indiana Public Broadcasting Station's statehouse and statewide politician reporter Brandon Smith about the debate in Westville, and we'll also call on the Times of Northwest Indiana's Doug Ross as well to find out what he has to say about the debate and other stories he has. And we have other items as well, including updates on the business scene in Northwest Indiana and elsewhere. This is Regionally Speaking, Reporters Roundtable Thursday here on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. It was an interesting night in Westville at the Purdue University Northwest campus when the three candidates for U.S. Senate showed up for their first of two debates. And let's find out one side of the story, so to speak, here. And Indiana Public Broadcasting's Statehouse reporter and state politics reporter Brandon Smith is with us. Brandon, thanks for being with us on the program today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, since you had a chance to make the trek up from Indianapolis to Westville.
I did indeed. Yeah.
Tell us first what you saw. It's just kind of opening up your reporter's notebook here. And tell us what you saw when you arrived on campus. What was the atmosphere like compared to what you may have seen maybe from some other debates and certainly ones from Indianapolis?
Yeah, there was a decent-sized crowd that the Democratic Party had kind of put together to greet Joe Donnelly when he arrived. The same could not be said for Republican Mike Braun, though up in that part of the state, it's generally a little more friendly towards Democrats, so that's kind of natural. You didn't really have protesters in either direction for either of those candidates that you might sometimes see at an event in Indianapolis where both parties are headquartered, obviously, and they can kind of mobilize a little more easily. So it was a fairly quiet atmosphere, at least beforehand. I got in the building fairly early on. I will say this, though. Driving up, I drove up 421 there from Lafayette, and you go through several small towns, mostly in Republican-dominated areas. And while I saw a lot of political signs on the road, mostly for local candidates, there were a few for Joe Donnelly, especially as you got further north, which makes sense. I didn't see a single sign in anybody's yard, in any public right-of-way, anything like that. I didn't see a single sign for Mike Braun, and that's got to worry him a little bit when you talk about enthusiasm of voters in those hardcore Republican areas.
I know that there have been some remarks made by some other political pundits that have noted about the fact that there's a strange difference that they note, a very different difference in Mike Braun's approach to this campaign for the November election as opposed to when he was fighting off two other challengers to be able to win the nomination for his own party.
Yeah, one thing is the ad strategy, his ads on TV. One thing that made him really stand out in the GOP primary was the ads that he was running. Quite frankly, they were really good. They were funny in a lot of cases. They poked fun, but like genuine criticisms at both of his opponents, trying to tie them together as both congressmen and so, you know, kind of play the outsider role. And in the general election, it's felt like he's been a little bit more on the back foot. Often his ads are sort of responding to attacks from Democrats as opposed to being out in front and putting Joe Donnelly in the defensive posture. So I don't think he's had the same kind of success in the general election so far that we saw with his ad strategy. It'll be interesting to see in these last few weeks if anything stands out.
I get the impression, and maybe you do too, that it seems like that Joe Donnelly came out swinging in the early questions there after the introductions.
Without a doubt, both in the campaign and then in the post-debate press conference with reporters, Joe Donnelly spent the majority of his time talking about Mike Braun and attacking Mike Braun, and I think that caught a lot of people by surprise. There was a general sense that he would have to do some of that, that naturally the tone of the race so far, what we expected from Mike Braun, Joe Donnelly was going to have to sort of punch back, but it wasn't so much punching back as he was out in front swinging, and I think some people were surprised by that. I don't know if that will play well with voters or not, and I think a lot of other people don't know that either, but it was certainly the strategy he decided to go with.
Do you think that maybe that's one reason that he, because he knew he was going up against the decision that was made not to support Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh in the final vote, do you think that he had to be defensive on that respect?
You have to believe that, yes. He knew he was going to get criticized for that. He'd already been criticized by the Braun campaign, by Republicans, over the weekend after the vote was actually made, the week previous when he announced that he wasn't going to vote for him. You knew he was prepared for that. But it wasn't just on that issue, though that did come up early on. It was on a lot of stuff. At one point, he interrupted Mike Braun. No other candidate really interrupted another one in that debate on Monday night. He was the only one to interrupt, and I would not have expected that from the way Joe Donnelly has run his campaigns and sort of presented himself over the last 6-7 years.
Now we're going to have a chance to listen to Doug Ross here from the Times of Northwest Indiana, because he went with a colleague that was interested about, the debate itself. We know that one of the topics that was brought up, of course, was dealing with the Affordable Care Act. Well, but one of the other things I did want to ask in particular about is what impression that you got from the audience about Lucy Brenton, because she's not been out campaigning very much as a Libertarian candidate up here in Northwest Indiana, I don't believe. I'm sure that this was probably, for many people, the very first time they ever met her.
Sure. Lucy Brenton has a little bit of the benefit in that she ran for the U.S. Senate in 2016 as well, so this is not her first go-round doing one of these, and certainly you saw that in the debate. She hit on some of the same themes that she hit on back when she was debating Todd Young and Evan Bayh 2 years ago, but she was more polished. She was a little more punchy in the sense of, really, really good quips, and quite frankly, in the media room, we in the media aren't allowed to sit in the auditorium where the debate actually takes place, so we sit back amongst our fellow reporters. So generally, and genuinely, some of her comments elicited some chuckles where she obviously intended them to, kind of thing. But she won't get more than likely 5 or 6% of the vote. That's generally where Libertarians have been. She got 5.5% 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
But in a race that's expected to be as close as Indiana's Senate race is, that could make a difference.
I suppose in this case, too, that even though there may be very strong supporters for Senator Donnelly and very strong supporters for Republican challenger Mike Braun, that there may be a number of independents out there who don't like either of the candidates, and they may in turn feel that maybe Lucy Brenton may be a good option to choose.
That's absolutely part of her appeal. I mean, she talked about it more than once, and certainly the quote that I used of hers in my story was the part where she talks about this is, once again, this is the old parties trying to make you do something that you shouldn't have to do kind mm-hmm. of deal. And that's her appeal. There are hardcore Libertarian voters in Indiana that she will definitely get votes from. The question is, can she siphon any of those voters out there who might normally go for either the Republican or the Democrat? And again, in a race that's expected to be as tight as this one is, that could make a difference.
What's been your take in talking with folks in Indianapolis now after this first of the two debates has finished, and now everybody's looking forward to the one coming up on October 30th in Indianapolis?
I don't think anybody sees these as huge game changers. Generally, what you're looking for out of the candidates is for neither one of them to make a gaffe so huge that it sways the election. Like, for instance, in 2012, when Joe Donnelly first won his Senate seat, and many people attribute that win in part to the fact that Republican candidate Richard Murdoch made what's considered a gaffe when he said that children born from rape are a gift from God, and then
right.
doubled down on that later that evening and then the next day. Mike Braun didn't make any sort of statement like that. Neither did Joe Donnelly in another direction. We don't expect that from either one of them in the October 30th debate. But again, if there are a few voters out there who are wondering which one of these folks they should choose, they might tune in to that October 30th debate in particular if they're trying to make up their minds at that late date.
So they may not be getting that Murdoch moment this time around, but they may have something else that may make them, it's confirmed to them at least, that either of the candidates is going to be the one to choose.
That's right, although I think there's a sense among a lot of people that if you're actually watching or listening to the U.S. Senate debate in Indiana live when it happens, whether it was this past Monday or on October 30th, you probably follow politics close enough that you know who you're voting for.
Mm-hmm. Well, Brandon, we really appreciate you spending some time with us here to talk about this. We know that you have other conversations that you have with some of the other candidates. In fact, one of them is from Northwest Indiana, so we better let you get off to that so you have a chance to talk with the candidate here in more detail. And we appreciate you spending some time with us today, too.
Absolutely. Always happy to do it.
Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith's been with us here. One of the other reporters who was in the room listening and watching what was happening at the U.S. Senate candidates debate at Purdue University Northwest in Westville is Doug Ross, who's with the Times of Northwest Indiana. It happens to be in an area that he typically covers up there in LaPorte and in the Porter counties. And thanks for joining us today, Doug, to talk about at least your take on what you saw and heard the senatorial candidates talk about.
Well, honestly, I think Lucy Brenton is the Libertarian candidate who said, you know, basically we're standing in her case, sitting in the audience's case, but we're just listening to Mike Braun and Joe Donnelly trade their commercials back and forth, which, you know, is basically true. They made a lot of the same points that they do in all their commercials. What I thought was interesting was their take on health care. That was, you know, one of the big issues. I mean, climate change was the most asked question as they were gathering up. They asked that once, but health care came up again and again and again. And basically, it came down to two issues. One was the whole idea of abortion and the Roe v. Wade decision from, as I recall, it was 73, but that decision by the U.S. Supreme Court that allowed women to have choice of whether or not to have an abortion, you know, kind of, you know, became concrete law at that point. So that was, you know, a contentious thing where Donnelly is saying, I think that it should be allowed in cases of rape or incest or whether mother's life is in danger, and then put it back on his Republican opponent, saying, you're even more conservative than Richard Murdoch, who ran against him 6 years ago. If you remember in that race, that was the one where Murdoch, you know, made an extreme comment about rape and incest and lost the election as a result. It kind of got special handlers after that comment in the debate.
I recall after that remark was made last time around that other people, and even just in talking with Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith, that was back then that was the comment that probably swayed a lot of people to make a decision for Joe Donnelly as opposed to Rich Murdoch.
Right, and so Donnelly's point in this debate last Monday was that Braun is not even saying, hey, if the mother's life is in danger, let's, you know, allow the family and the doctor to, and the minister, I guess, you know, whatever their faith leader might be, to have a say in, you know, should we save the mother's life at the expense of the fetus or not? And so that was a pretty interesting point, I thought. And Braun, frankly, didn't really refute that, or at least not effectively, I thought. So that was interesting. And then the other interesting was the whole issue of how you bring down the cost of health care, period. And so Braun is saying, you know, here's what I did for my business as I drove down the cost and not just held it in place, which, you know, would be remarkable enough. But he was making the point of, you know, he negotiated with providers and so forth and did these things that made his employers happier and drove down the cost of insurance for him as well, as a business owner. So there's that. And then there's Donnelly from his standpoint saying, look what I did in protecting Obamacare. I was the decisive vote in preventing the Republicans in Congress from eliminating protection for pre-existing conditions, for example. You know, when you talk about Obamacare, you think about a lot of things, but, you know, some of the big changes were, you know, that exact point was that if you had a pre-existing condition, you often were not even able to get insurance, let alone, you know, paying a higher premium. So Obamacare addressed that, and it also allows people who were falling through the gaps, basically, of coverage, were young adults up to age 26 who really, you know, were still not on the, able to get coverage on their own at that point. You know, maybe they were still in school. Maybe, you know, they didn't have the kind of job that offered the insurance benefits. But that was one of the other big changes of Obamacare. And Donnelly is saying, you know, basically, I protected your children and your grandchildren. And so that was, you know, one of his strong points during the whole thing.
And I also know, too, that it was mentioned during the debate, and you mentioned in your story in the Times about Donnelly mentioning his right to try measure that even the president seemed to be supportive of. And you brought that up as a point. That was some other way, too, to not only help help people that need the help medically, but also to help keep the costs under control.
Yeah, so what the right to try, and I'm glad you mentioned that, what the right to try provision is if you're terminally ill, you know, basically, if you've got no other hope of you know, curing yourself, why shouldn't you have the ability to get a drug that hasn't been approved yet? What have you got to lose? I mean, and so this was one that Donnelly, you know, repeatedly stressed, hey, you know, you say I can't work, you know, with the Republicans, that I'm ineffective and all that, but, you know, your own party's president, Donald Trump, commended me personally on this. And so, you know, that was a big deal. So that was pretty interesting, too. What Braun was trying to do is paint Donnelly with a very liberal brush and say, you know, you're taking your marching orders from Chuck Schumer, he's running your campaign, et cetera, et cetera. What Donnelly was trying to do is say, hey, I'm a moderate, and by the way, you, Mr. Braun, are even more conservative than my 2012 opponent.
Mm-hmm.
So that's basically what the voters have a choice of, is, you know, who's, you know, where along the spectrum does Donnelly fall? The Kavanaugh thing, for example, will be a touch point for a lot of people. And by Kavanaugh, I'm, of course, talking to the new U.S. Supreme Court justice that went through the hearing, you know, was challenged and, right, and really just narrowly got appointed to the court. So Donnelly voted against him. He was, you know, still became justice after all because of the Republican, huge Republican majority. But still, there will be, the Republicans are saying that, you know, that issue is firing up our base, that, you know, one of the things the Republicans needed to do and have really kind of succeeded in is packing the Supreme Court with conservative justices. And so, you know, they want to keep doing that as much as they can, which, you know, makes sense if you're a Republican. And then the Democrats are, you know, saying, you know, this was a Me Too movement that got botched because he was accused of assaulting Dr. Ford, and basically nobody listened. That he was confirmed anyway. Mm-hmm. So that's a pretty interesting situation there. So we'll see how that plays out in this race as well.
Your story also mentions about the fact that some folks that were in the audience had a chance to ask some questions. One of them in particular was an employee of Purdue University Northwest in Hammond, and she asked about the concern about how much students should have to carry in debt, and asked the candidates for their opinions about that.
Yeah, so that was Lisa Kovacs. She's a Portage resident, actually. And so she was saying that, you know, here we have this huge issue with debt. We, you know, you saw the Great Recession and, you know, how there was this whole thing with real estate and the housing bubble and so forth. Well, you've got the same thing with student debt where you've got, you know, a $1 trillion issue. And this is something that if you have, you know, a federal student loan, you can't discharge that in bankruptcy. You can't say, you know, I just flat out can't do it. And you know, like you can with other debt, say mortgages. And so this is going to be a huge issue that frankly, everybody's trying to figure out how to do it. Braun was saying, for instance, that the former governor, now Purdue president, Mitch Daniels, has frozen tuition at Purdue since becoming president. You know, he's you know, doing all of these things to drive down costs, basically, you know, watching purchasing and benefits and so forth, so and trying to move students through college faster, frankly, and so that you know, helps Purdue keep their tuition frozen. Donnelly was saying, you know, one of the first things he's focused on is protecting the Pell Grants, you know, making sure that students can continue to get the federal loan that they need to, you know, be able to afford college. So, but then that's, you know, brings on the whole idea of student debt. Mm-hmm. So that's a tough one. I mean, you know, I hear that, and ironically, I'm at a Purdue campus in Westville right now talking to you, but, you know, there's this whole issue of, has the state of Indiana, in this case, has the state, you know, been continuing its fair share of paying for the cost of a college education, where, you know, college costs keep going up. The theory is the state's share hasn't been. And so there's that whole issue. So really education, you know, and this is a young people issue, you know, and parents. How are you going to be able to get the college education you need to be able to, you know, be a successful person if you can't afford to pay the loan? Mm-hmm. So
besides the debate coverage that you offered in the Times, I know one of the other stories that you've had out there for people to see, either in print or online, is the beginning of early voting that's underway now here in Northwest Indiana, with the registration period ending earlier this week. And you mentioned about some reaction to folks in Porter County, in particular those who work in the voter registration office. Are they ready for what they hope will be an influx of folks coming in early to vote?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, they had a little problem yesterday. The Hebrew Town Hall lost power, and that was one of the polling places. So they had that issue where people just couldn't vote. There was one issue with, you know, one of the printers, you know, that print out the ballots wasn't working right. So they had to scramble to get that done. But the really biggest news out of all of this is that even more, and I talked to registration, voter registration, you know, election administrators in Lake, Porter, and LaPorte counties. And in all three counties, they are saying that more people registered this year than in a typical midterm election. And that seems to have been reflected in the first day of early voting yesterday, that, you know, not as many people as in a presidential election voted by, you know, certainly. It was a couple hundred less than that in Lake County, for example, but, you know, way, way, way more than in 2014, which is like the last time we had a midterm election. And by midterm, I should explain, we're talking about, you know, halfway between presidential elections.
You kind of mentioned here, and when you're referring to in your story about the problems that they had in Porter County at the administration center, they lost power. That's, and you mentioned that's, of course, one of the early voting sites. What are some of the other ones that folks in Porter County can turn to if they wish to vote early?
Okay, so there's the Porter County Hebron Town Hall, I should have been clear, was the one that lost power.
Oh, okay.
So there's that one. There's the Porter County Administration Center. There's, I'm trying to remember, there's the in Union Township, there's a fire station in, like, just outside of Wheeler, so on 130. So there's one there. Mm-hmm. I think that's the one. Union Township has two fire stations. So it's either that one or the other one. It has it. Chesterton, let's see.
Oh,
Chesterton,
Town Hall,
and,
yeah.
And Portage, right.
Yeah.
So and the Portage one's at the North County Government Complex. So, so there are five sites in Porter County to go vote. There are, as I recall, there's 11 in Lake County. They're scattered all over. Mm-hmm. And and two in LaPorte County. You can either go to the courthouse in Michigan City or the courthouse in LaPorte and vote there. And, but if you go to if you vote early in LaPorte County, you got to remember that, you know, these are courthouses, and so they've got higher security there. So you've got to make sure you leave your, you know, cell phones and, you know, all the electronic gizmos that you might otherwise carry with you. You got to leave those in your car when you go in.
Well, that's a good note, certainly, to remember, and a good note to wrap things up here today. Doug Ross, thank you very much for being with us to talk not only about your coverage of the Senate debate that happened at Purdue Northwest in Westville, but also an update, too, on the early voting process is underway right now. Thank you for being with us.
Oh, thank you for the invitation. Glad to be here.
In Lake County, Doug had mentioned about 11 locations that are open for early voting, and they are the Lake County Board of Elections and Voter Registration Office. That's in the Government Center in Crown Point on Main Street. Also, the courthouses in East Chicago, as well as in Hammond. That's on Russell Street, by the way, in Hammond. We have, of course, town halls in Lowell and Schererville that are set up for early voting. We have the Wicker Park Social Center, which is located in Wicker Park on Indianapolis Boulevard in Highland. And in addition, early voting is also set up for residents who want to come to the Genesis Center in Gary, the Hobart Police Station, the Munster Town Hall, the Township Assessor's Office in St. John, which is on Wicker Avenue. Winfield's Town Hall is also set up for early voting. And we have a note, too, that, of course, that your early voting opportunities will end at noon on November 5th. From time to time, we bring you updates on Hoosier Business News, and they come from the Inside Indiana Business team in Indianapolis. That's what Insiders is all about here. This week on this edition, we're bringing you, we have Gary Dick is joined by guests, Indy Chamber Chief Executive Development Officer Maureen Krause from Mesro Financial, Retirement Planning and Advisory Client Relationship Manager Bruce Kidd, and the publisher of IndyPolitics.org, Abdul Hakim Shabazz. And this week, we'll find out more what these guests have to talk about with Gary Dick about, among other things, White Lodging's major development that is planned in Merrillville, Sweetwater Audio's $76 million expansion in Fort Wayne, and the first 16-tech building that is being fully leased. Here's the conversation.
All to the insiders. This week, a couple of big economic development deals, big project deals, if you will, announced this week. Maureen, in northwest Indiana, Merrillville. Mm-hmm. Lots of folks remember the Star Theater and the Radisson mm-hmm. Hotel, I-65 and US 30 there in Merrillville. That has gone by the wayside. It's been taken down. This week, White Lodging announced plans for a $350 million project that would include hotels, retail, residential, horse areas, all a destination essentially mm-hmm. created there to replace what was an iconic place with a new destination.
Well, I think that's a fantastic, first of all, the size of the development for that part of the state is mm-hmm. tremendous. It's, you know, it's day trip, it's destination, but it really is pointing to, I think, what families are looking for is easy couple day activities. Reuse of existing facilities or existing space is so essential for a community. You just shouldn't let things die. Yeah. Figure out a better use, a more current use, or use for a future. So a lot of good to come out of that development. And it, once again, the size is really amazing.
Yeah. And I think another example of the White family giving back to Indiana, Abdul, what is the significance in your view of the location in northwest Indiana? It's, you know, it's the gateway to Chicago,
gateway
as they
to Chicago.
Call it.
Yeah. You're with, easily within, as somebody who grew up in the city, within an hour's drive of almost anywhere from the city of Chicago, depending on, of course, traffic. You can bring people to, you know, northwestern Indiana. It sort of also revitalizes that area. I always kind of jokingly say northwest Indiana sometimes tends to be sort of the Forgottonia of Indiana when we talk about development and where things are going. But it shows that, you know, once again, you know, every part of the state is vibrant, healthy, and sort of and making a comeback.
Yeah. Another big announcement this week came in northeast Indiana in Fort Wayne with a great Indiana entrepreneurial success story. Sweetwater, they used to be called Sweetwater Sound. They're the musical equipment and audio equipment dealer. It's grown into a really a large company, about 1,300 employees. Bruce, this week announced plans to add 1,000 additional jobs with a $76-plus million investment.
Chuck Surak, I had the pleasure to meet him several years ago. He's built a phenomenal company, and he is, like you talked about, the whites in Northwest Indiana. He's very committed to that part of the state and has built a real foundational company for that region. And I have lots of friends that are in the music business, and they're all customers of his because they have fantastic products, they have fantastic people.
And customer service.
They just keep building and building. It's remarkable.
What does this say, Bruce, in your view, and anybody can jump in on this, but Chuck was on the show earlier this week and said, hey, we had offers from a lot of other places, especially out west, Vegas, the West Coast, where they've got a lot of customers. And he said, frankly, the offers, some of them were better financially, but he points to, he's from Northeast Indiana, he loves Fort Wayne, but he likes what's going on there from a momentum standpoint.
I mean, he can be the lead dog, you know, if you will, in a revival or an expansion of that area. I'm sure he had great offers to go other places. I mean, we're not the centerpiece of the entertainment industry.
Right.
But he's built such a strong foundation there, and he's so committed to the community. I'm delighted to see that he stayed.
And you can never underestimate the value of building in your own backyard and sort of, you know, being home. This is where I'm from. You know, this is a place that has treated me well, made me the person I am. This is, once again, like you said, Gary, that way of sort of giving back to that community to help make you what you are.
I think it shows, first of all, that, you know, business leaders appreciate the culture of the community they're in as well, where they can be successful and grow. And also, it's a great example of the strong manufacturing sort of history we have. But with the infusion of technology, we're so good at that in this state. And companies are growing and becoming global players by doing that.
Yeah, should mention a milestone for another big development. This one in central Indiana, the 16 Tech Community Corporation announcing that the first big building there is now fully leased. Will include the Indiana Biosciences Research Institute and some other tenants in that building. Maureen, as you look at that, this is a massive talent play, really. But just getting that first building, something you can see the impact that has.
We can show really cool maps and drawings and renditions, but once the steel starts going up, and because it's a beautiful plan, once we have a physical thing to show, it's going to be more rapid with the development going on there. So we're very excited for this announcement. It's a very solid start to 16 Tech.
Yep. I want to get your take, Maureen, on the new trade agreement between the U.S., Mexico, and Canada, replacing NAFTA. It's the United States, Mexico, Canada agreement, right? There you go. Very good. Now, the trade tariffs on steel, aluminum, not part of this. But agriculture is a big part of this agreement.
I think even in Indiana, the steel component of all of these trade discussions and tariff discussions has been big and is still impacting our companies. The uncertainty is still causing companies to see rising prices. You know, we hear of layoffs in different spots. But I think a little bit agriculture's been forgotten. And when you look at the trade agreements, including the new NAFTA, because I still can't let it roll off my tongue, the USMCA or whatever. NAFTA 2.0, I think the agriculture component is something that is equally important in our area, whether it's on milk prices or other, you know, soy or corn. So really important that we keep on this, and hopefully it will provide our firms some certainty so they can make decisions for the next year forward.
Do you get a sense that it will be positive, negative, no impact on Indiana?
The certainty will be positive.
Yep.
Because smart businesses will now be able to make smart plans with that certainty.
It's about to make better plans, but I think, you know, this agreement is almost sort of overestimated, because at the end of the day, Indiana farmers who grow soybeans are, this has nothing to do with that. They're still going to be hurting because China is the big deal when
China,
it comes to
that's
when,
absolutely true.
When
China
comes,
still
the it's still the big player when it comes to our soybeans. And number two, anybody who thinks that these agreements are going to bring jobs back, you are woefully mistaken. Automation has done more to take away a lot of these jobs than NAFTA and trade deals ever have and ever will.
The other thing that doesn't get in this, and not to start a whole new segment here, but immigration policies have impacted our agriculture community as well, hence the need for automation if you have less workforce available. So that's another factor that really there's several different things at play here.
Gotcha. Bruce, want to get your take on a report out this week on Indiana's tax climate. Once again, some good news for the state. Washington, D.C.-based Tax Foundation's state business tax climate ranks Indiana number 10 in the country and, again, number one in the Midwest.
Yeah. It's, I mean, this is a longstanding highlight of our state, that it's a great place to do business, and part of that is our tax structure.
Yep.
We've top 10 for years now, have we not?
Yep.
And as we were talking off camera, if you look at some of the states that are in front of us as far as top 10, I would be hard-pressed to believe that those states are going to recruit the kind of companies that we're recruiting to our state mm-hmm. to set up shop. Mm-hmm. They might have great task bases, but I don't know that they've got the infrastructure, the support, the higher education, the workforce that we have. And so I think we're in a terrific position for the next decade.
Very good. Before we leave, Abdul, I want to get your take on State School Superintendent Jennifer McCormick unleashing her legislative agenda, but really making big news because you were there. She said, hey, I'm not running for re-election.
Yeah, we were there for, just for end of session, sort of begin next session report, what she was going to do. Next thing you know, oh, by the way, I'm not running again. Well, what?
Yeah.
And so she said, some of the noise, some of the back and forth she'd have with lawmakers. Shocking to the point, but if you sort of follow this career long, not really surprising because of the superintendent just never could quite break through some of that educational glass ceiling that had been there in the legislature.
Do you think this pushes then, there's been talk of making that position appointed, right?
Yeah, the law was changed last session to make it 2024. With her not running again, I wouldn't be surprised if it's come 2020.
Move that up. Okay, yeah. Very good. Abdul Hakeem Shabazz, Maureen Krause, Bruce Kidd, thank you one and all.
Inside Indiana Business is Indiana's only statewide business television program and radio. It's seen on flagship stations here in Northwest Indiana as well. And you can find out more about Inside Indiana Business programming by going onto their website, insideindianabusiness.com, or to check out their YouTube channel as well. Just search for Inside Indiana Business. The Indiana Debate Commission got more questions about climate change for the Senate debate between the three candidates in Westville than for any other topic. And Indiana Public Broadcasting's environmental reporter Rebecca Thiel delves into what this might have to say about Hoosier voters.
Nearly 15% of all Senate debate questions contain the phrase climate change. Indiana Debate Commission President Jerry Linowska says that's even more than the word marijuana, a popular subject in debates. The commission doesn't have hard data on past debate topics, but anecdotally, Linowska says climate change seems to be on people's minds more this election cycle.
I think it certainly reflects that there's a growing sense of urgency among some subset of voters out there who really want to see this issue addressed.
Linowska says most of the people who asked about climate change were from university communities and tended to vote Democratic or Independent, though some of those Independents say they often vote Republican. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Rebecca Thiel.
This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. It's going to be another Gary International Black Film Festival happening on the IU Northwest campus in Gary. Some great films to be shown this year, as always, and we have with us the founder of the Gary International Black Film Festival, Karen Toering. Karen, thanks for joining us on Regionally Speaking today. If you will, tell us, for folks that are not familiar with what the Gary International Black Film Festival is, how it got started, and the types of films that people get to see when they come to campus this year.
Okay. The Gary International Black Film Festival is literally that. It's a film festival that features films that are either by or about black people across in the United States and across the diaspora. And it was founded, this is our eighth year, so I cannot believe that we've been actually able to do this for the last 7 years. So we're pretty excited about this year. It's a three-day event with films beginning on Friday and running all the way through Sunday, Friday, October the 12th, through Sunday, October 14th. And it's an opportunity to really just take a deep dive into films, films about documentaries, about things and people and events that happened within our time and history, dramatic films that feature really great storytelling, funny films that, are about the quirky ways that life kind of gets at us, and just an opportunity to see some really good film, craftsmanship, for lack of a better term. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
I know that it's always been, now with this upcoming eighth annual
Festival, that it's always been an opportunity not only to showcase independent black film activity that may come in, but in particular here in Northwest Indiana and the city of Gary, mainly, because I know it's always been the effort to be able to help build a very vibrant and very active film-going community, not only those attending films, but those who make it.
That's the nice part about it. I think one of the things that we did when we founded the film festival was very much intentionally made it an opportunity not only to see a film, but also to have a conversation about it, right? Mm-hmm. So we bring in filmmakers who are, you know, some of them are emerging, some of them are really well established. A few years ago, we had Robert Townsend, who has made a really funny film called Hollywood Shuffle.
Oh,
and
yes.
And he came to town. Yeah, remember that film?
Oh, yes. It was a great film.
And but he had another film that he had done about a boys' school in the near south, like South Carolina or something like that. And, you know, he's a filmmaker. He, you know, just because you made one film doesn't mean you stop. And so, you know, we also have filmmakers that no one's ever heard of, at least not yet. And to me, that's the exciting part about it, the opportunity to talk to an emerging filmmaker, you know, about their film, and then just sort of watch their career, you know, as they continue to make film, as they continue to do media. And I think that's what people like the most about the film festival.
And I know, too, part of the project itself is not only giving folks here a chance to see some great films that they may not see anyplace else, but it gives folks in Northwest Indiana and the city of Gary in particular a chance to get involved in actually making those films, and businesses supporting those filmmakers, too, I understand, mm-hmm. because a lot of businesses and a lot of nonprofits get very much involved in this, I understand.
Yeah, they do. We offered this opportunity. You know, we were trying to think of ways that, well, it's kind of like in the early days, just convincing people, right,
mm-hmm.
that it was worth their time to come to a film festival because, you know, it's like, well, what do you do at a film festival? Well, you watch films and you talk about them. And so, you know, as an incentive for, you know, nonprofits and educational institutions and things like that, we were like, well, you know, what if we offer the opportunity for you to receive a portion of the ticket sales? Like, you sell the tickets, and, you know, we, you know, give you half or a third. It just depends on what night of the film festival it is. And so then it's an opportunity for organizations to raise money and also, you know, see a film that may be about something that is really important to the work that they're doing. So nonprofits can join with us and, you know, basically host a film. And, you know, it's almost like feeding two birds with one hand.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not only do you raise money for your nonprofit, but, you know, the film has subject matter that is relevant to the work that you're doing. So then you get to use a different tool to get your message out. So, you know, and it's been pretty successful so far.
Now, I know that we don't have time, unfortunately, in our conversation today to go through all of the films. There are more than 40 short and feature-length films that are going to be involved in the festival. We should mention, though, that you can take a look at the full schedule on the website at GaryBlackFilmFest.com. And you can also go on that link as well, too, and get your tickets for the event. Let's talk about some of these major films that you're going to be bringing in particular, the opening night film, the red carpet reception, of course, gives folks a chance to have a great meal and see this very important film, which is entitled I, Angry Black Man. And tell us a little mm-hmm. bit about the fellow who's put this together, Menelik Lumumba. What got him interested in doing a film, the topic like being an angry black man?
Well, you know, it's called One Angry Black Man, and it basically is a play on the movie 12 Angry Men. And, you know, that's sort of like a courtroom drama.
Right.
So there are a lot of things in the film that are very, if you know the original film, there are a lot of things in One Angry Black Man that are very similar to 12 Angry Men, and that was the filmmaker's homage to that film. It takes place, whereas 12 Angry Men takes place mostly in that jury room, right? One Angry Black Man takes place in a college classroom. And as you go through the film, you see a lot of those, sort of similar themes and narratives about one person basically fighting for their truth. And the angry part is that, in a world where, you're told that, all you have to do is your best. The world, good things will happen to you or the world will reward you for just doing your best. It doesn't seem to be that way for this character. Mm-hmm. And the movie sort of dissects all of the reasons using history in the context of a classroom conversation that sort of, lets the audience understand why this young man is angry. And it's really well done. There's some funny scenes in it. The director, this is a first-time director, Menelik Lumumba. He's actually a professor of film at New Mexico State University in Albuquerque, New Mexico.
Wow.
And he and the cinematographer, whose name is Hans Charles, have been longtime friends. And Hans Charles is an award-winning cinematographer. In fact, he just, it was last year, won an Emmy for his work on the documentary 13th, which is about a prison and the 13th Amendment. And so Hans has been doing really incredible work as a cinematographer and also teaching at NYU. And so they met basically as academics and became lifelong friends. Lumumba kept saying, hey, man, one day I want to make a film. One day I want to make a film. And Hans, being, the seasoned cinematographer that he was like, okay, stop saying it. And let's do it.
Well, he just wants to turn around the expression of if one can do, they do it, and one who can't teaches. He wanted to turn that around. He wanted to reverse that completely from somebody who just teaches to somebody who actually does something. And he's certainly done very well with this one, with One Angry Black Man, that he's going to be able to show off here at IU Northwest on Friday, October 12th. I know there are always post-screening dialogues after each film is on. Will that be the case here with Menelik's film on opening night?
Yes. In fact, Lumumba and Charles will actually join us earlier on Friday at Westside High School. They'll be talking to students, just about making a film and a career, either in film or television or media. So they're going to go over to Westside and do that Friday morning. And then they will be here for the Friday night red carpet reception and opening night. And
that's great.
It should be pretty fun.
That's great.
Well, yeah, and the nice part about these two fellas is their friendship. You can see their friendship before they even enter the room. I mean, they're great friends, and they did some pretty great work.
That's wonderful. Well, as we mentioned before, there's a full schedule since there are so many films that are up on the 8th Annual Gary International Black Film Festival agenda for this year. And you can see it online on the website at GaryBlackFilmFest.com. And that's, as we mentioned, that's where you can get tickets. You can also get tickets as well, too, I guess, with the Urban League of Northwest Indiana. They have them there at the office on Broadway in Gary.
Yeah, they do. Well, they have opening night tickets, and they have full festival passes.
Oh, wonderful. So you can go make a choice. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right.
At the Urban League. And then, we will always have tickets at the door. So if folks want to come and see a film, and they, a lot of people don't necessarily buy tickets online, and that's why we always set aside a few tickets at the door each night for each show.
Now, we've mentioned here about the fact that the opening night red carpet reception and the film, One Angry Black Man, is going to be shown at the IU Northwest in the Berglund Auditorium on the Gary campus. Is that the place where all of these other films are held? Is it going to be just about every place in the campus there, and wherever they're going to have an opportunity to show a film, people can find where one is?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, this year, thanks for asking, Chris, because this year we're expanding our locations mm-hmm. that will be screening films. IU has been a really strong and great partner, and using the Berglund Auditorium is a perfect size for the festival. But we also have so many films this year that entered the festival. We were like, okay, how do we, you know, show all of this content and squeeze it all into one weekend? And so we will also be, some films will be at Indiana University Northwest. That's where opening night will be. And then on Saturday, we will have films both at Indiana University and at Art House, a social kitchen at 411 East Broadway, over on the east side.
That's great. That's great. And that's a great mm-hmm. venue to see films, too, because they've shown them there for some time since the Art House opened up. So it's going to be a great place to see some of these screenings as well, too. And as we mentioned, once again, that you can find out more about the films that are up on the 8th Annual Black Film Festival at GaryBlackFilmFest.com. And you can get the tickets available online. You can buy the tickets at the door of the various locations where films are going to be shown. And you can find out all about the films, all the ones that are going to be offered for this year's event on the website as well, too. You're listening to Regionally Speaking here on Lakeshore Public Radio. That was Karen Toering, who is the founder of the Gary International Black Film Festival, about the event that gets underway this Friday, tomorrow, October 12th, and continuing into the weekend with the showings of the films at the Berglund Auditorium at IU Northwest in Gary, as well as at the Art House and other locations around Gary. That's it for Regionally Speaking, Reporters Roundtable Thursday. Our thanks to Doug Ross of the Times of Northwest Indiana, as well as to Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith for joining us, and we'll be back with you on Monday.